And tonight's speaker comes to us from the Happy Hour Group in Beaufort. And I'm very excited to hear about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now with a very recent celebration of 19 years. So we have Frank.
My name is Frank Bison, and my sobriety date is May 31st, 2006. I was 27 when I got sober, and my beard was a different color back then. I might not have had one. I don't really remember very well. So I got this really important job today. They have no idea how burnt I am. I don't know. It just goes under the radar somehow, and I'm solving problems for all these people. It's crazy. My home group is the Happy Hour Group in Beaufort. I live over in Beaufort. I spoke at a group in Toccoa about a month ago, and as soon as I walked away from the podium, I was like, man, you didn't even mention, like, the most important things about your sobriety. So I think that's a good place to start. I have an 11-year-old daughter. When I was 11, I looked up to my father, who was a drunk and a drug addict, and he lived with his mom, and he acted like the whole world owed him something. I thought he was amazing. And I don't act that way. And I participate in her life, and we sit down and we play games, and I ask her, how are you feeling? That's something AA gave us, and she's never seen me drink. And I got a 13-year-old daughter. When I was 13, I had already spent 2 weeks in a mental hospital for homicidal ideation, and I'd been expelled from eighth grade. This girl, she's awesome, involved in all these extracurricular activities, jujitsu and marching band and viola, and that's a gift we get from this program. It's what this program gave us. And she's never seen me drink. I have a 16-year-old son, and he is so unique. When I was 16, I'd already been arrested more times than I'm sure about. And I'd already been exposed to drinking and other things. All I wanted to do was party. Party, and I had a friend who had a beard when we were 16. We'd go to the liquor store, we'd ditch school, and just drink all day and have keggers. He's never seen me drink. This is a gift we get from this program. And I have this amazing wife, this amazing relationship. Before we got involved, I did something crazy. I made an ideals list of what I was looking for in a partner, and God put her in my life at the absolute most challenging time in my entire life. She just popped up and was at my side through some really hard stuff, and I'm going to get to that because that's pretty wild. And we have a beautiful relationship. We talk things out, you know? It's really, really beautiful. It's really beautiful. So that's a good beginning. So when I was 18, I graduated from high school. I don't know how. Like, I literally don't know how. I ditched school all the time. Me and my friends always getting into trouble, drinking and all that stuff. My grandfather had just died. This is the best explanation I have. He died and he reached down from heaven and he changed my grades or something. I got no explanation for how it happened. I think that's what happened. I really, really do. And I had no goals. I had no aspirations to do anything. And I had like two sets of friends at this time. I had this set of friends who, they started families and they went to college and they stopped going to keggers. They grew up. And then I had this set of friends that got into crimes that were a little bit outside of my comfort zone and were going to prison. I was good, just doing nothing. You know, middle of the road, not making a choice. And I worked in a restaurant, and I lived with my parents, and I was fine with that for a while. And then my mom shared with me, she had this dream. I'm from Chicago. That's where I grew up. She had this dream to live in Florida. Apparently, she'd had this dream for years and years. I didn't know, probably because I was too busy focused on partying and everything. And she said, I'm moving to Florida. And I was like, absolutely not. There's no way I'm going to Florida. I'm staying here in Chicago where I belong. They moved to Florida, and I get this apartment. And that's when I started breaking some personal rules I'd made up in my mind based on seeing my father as a kid. This is when I started drinking and everything in the morning and drinking and driving. And I had this kind of wild lifestyle for a little while. I had this apartment And it was right next to the train station. And I'd wake up in the morning, start partying. I'd go to the restaurant, get it set up, work lunch shift, come out with some cash, and then, you know, hang out to the apartment or hop on the train and go downtown. And I did that for a few years. And I started experimenting with all kinds of stuff that were, like, off limits before. And my standards for living kind of went like this. And as they did, I was like, no, this is all right. That's fine. It's fine. This is good. No, this is good. This is where I want to be, you know. And it just kept getting worse. Those friends kept doing better. And, oh, I was so jealous. I was so jealous of them. And then I had this seething resentment towards my parents, my mother and stepfather, for moving to Florida. And it grew. And I was, like, angry. And I felt like the world owed me something. And, you know, there's all kinds of nonsensical trauma stuff that made it onto my fifth step that could be part of my story. But this is really where things, like, went downhill fast for me. My apartment turned into kind of like a trap house, really. People in and out all the time, strangers, and I'd just, strangers in there, and I'd just leave. I'd play guitar, and I'd sling my guitar around my back, drunk, get on the train, go downtown, and I had this fantasy that I just needed to be at the right place at the right time, and someone would discover me, and I'd be famous, and that I just gotta wait. I gotta wait for my moment. I gotta be there, you know? So things go like this for a couple of years, and I get to this point where I stop returning my mom's calls. I'm estranged from my real dad. I got this sister who lives right down the street. I'm estranged from her. She probably picked up on, oh, Frank's going to be just like Dad. I don't want to have anything to do with that. And she really stopped participating in my life. My mom had this job where she traveled, but the headquarters were still in Chicago. So sometimes she would come, and at first we'd like go out to lunch or, you know, catch up. And like I said, I stopped returning her calls. So one day she just stops by to check on me. And things were not good, man. Like, it was not a good scene. Like, it was everywhere, you know what I mean? And you look in the refrigerator, and there's just gallons of beer and one ketchup bottle. I got a mattress with no frame and a computer with no computer desk and a TV with no TV stand. And I got this cockeyed couch. It looks like someone threw up in it or something. And I got all these tickets taped on the wall of when I'm supposed to go to court. Because someone really kind was like, oh, Frank, we're going to help you get organized. And they put all my tickets on the wall so I'd know when I had to go to court. She said, please come to Florida and start over. And I was like, yes, an oasis. That's what we'll do. We'll go to Florida. We're going to start over. You know, we're going to turn it all around. So, and still, I got this resentment, like, how could you leave me, and all this stuff, and they're doing so well, and, you know, and all this, oh, God, you know, it's such a mess up here. I turned into such a mess. So I go down to Florida, and they help me get a Florida license, and I need to get a job. So I go get a job at this pretty busy spring break kind of establishment, and now I don't even pay rent. Now I'm just living at Mom's house. Kind of starting to turn into my dad. There's a part of me that knew this wasn't where I wanted to be, but I was like, it's fine. Like we tell ourselves, it's all right. This is fine. Now we got a whole new cycle. Same story. I get up in the morning, and I'm like, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm turning it around. And I go to work, and I get off $400 in cash in my pocket, and I'm like, I could have one. Or they'll be like, oh, Frank, you can have one. Like, yeah, absolutely, I can have one. Just like in the book, man, hanging on that bar. Like, how did I get like this? And then they're like, yeah, what? Man, I can't remember. What do they say at the end of the night? Last call, right? Oh man, that's how long it's been. They say last call, and I'd be like, what? Last call? No, we gotta keep going. And like everyone else is like ready to go home, and I'm like, no, we gotta find a party or something, you know? And then my mom had spent years going to Al-Anon, and she had dealt with my father. My real father was an alcoholic, and you know, she knew. She knew, and she'd say things like, you know, Frank, I think you might have the disease. And I would just laugh at her and be like, Mom, you're so ridiculous, the disease. It's fine. And I'd be in the bathroom throwing up my guts, and her little voice knocking on the door, are you okay? Yeah, Mom, I'm fine. Just another night. So I've known about Alcoholics Anonymous all my life. I went to my first meeting when I was 6 years old with my dad. And I saw him quit drinking and start living a better life. I don't know what happened. He stopped going, and he just went back to doing what he used to do. And I have an aunt who at that time, in this time frame I'm talking about, I think she had about 20 years of sobriety. And she visited us for Christmas one year, and I saw she was going to AA meetings. And so I was asking her questions, like, what do you do there? What do you talk about? And she's like, no, it's just, you know, really nice people. You know, we're going to go have a picnic later. And she didn't, she knew. She could spot it, but she didn't say, you need to. All along, though, I found out later, she'd been praying every night, please, God, help Frank. And she told me this years later. But I knew where the AA meeting was because I saw her going there. Things just kept getting worse for me. I got obsessed with some girl, and my friend at the time in Florida was obsessed with the same girl. And so we'd find each other at a bar, and we'd just start fighting. And finally, one night, I was at work, and he was there, and I was drunk at work. And we got into a fight. He, like, body slammed me to the ground, and I lost my job. And, like, something needed to change. I didn't know what to expect. I walked into my first AA meeting, and I saw that sign that says, you don't have to be alone anymore. And that just really encapsulated how I'd felt. I really did feel like I'd always been alone, doing everything on my own, figuring things out on my own. And I was lonely. I was really, really lonely. It's like I had this bottomless pit, and alcohol used to fill it. But it got to a point where when I would drink, it would make the pit worse. And then I need something else. And then I got to the point where the something else made that pit worse too. And I just wanted to die. I just wanted to die all the time. It was a terrible existence. So when I walked into that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting for the first time and saw that sign, it was like, oh, really? Because I've been lonely for a really long time. These people were talking about their drinking. And not like me and my friends talking about our drinking. They were talking about how when they drank, they would have that idea, well, I'm just going to have one, and then I lose control. And it dawned on me that that is what happens, that I have one drink, and then I lose control over all the drinks I'm going to have for the rest of the night. And I don't stop until something stops me or I pass out. And I knew that. And I was drinking with intent sometimes to just get completely smashed. And they would talk about that too. And they would talk about how they would want to stop and couldn't. And that's what was happening to me. Because I would wake up in the morning so determined, like, I'm not going to drink today. Just today, I'm just not going to drink. And still, I would be at the bar and someone would hand me a beer, and I'd be like, yeah, all right, I can do that. And same thing would happen. So I felt like I belonged there. I didn't know if I was an alcoholic, but I felt like I belonged. So I kept coming, and I found myself going to 3 meetings a day for a while and not sure if I was an alcoholic. Finally, someone said, you know, you should get a sponsor. I thought about that, and they're like, you should read this big book. And someone bought me a book. And I'm like, yeah, it's all about God. Oh, no. Mm-mm. No, we're not doing that. So I wasn't really down with doing the deal, but I like to steal a little feeling better from the meetings. I got that. And I was sober for 30 days, and then I went and hung out with old friends that I was drinking with before. And they convinced me to have one. They're like, you've been sober 30 days. You can have one beer. And I was like, yeah, of course. And man, I'll tell you, I woke up the next morning on the beach. And I have no idea what happened. I went back to AA. And they did not get mad at me. They didn't throw me out. They asked me what had happened. They asked me if I wanted to pick up another white chip. You know, I didn't get in trouble. Someone was like, that's what we do. That's what happens. I was like, all right, I'll get a sponsor. I got a sponsor, and we started working some steps. And I got a little bit of more financial security, ego. It's like, oh, I'm feeling better now. And I was sober for 90 days, and I decided to go on a cruise to the Bahamas. I brought my big book, and I found where all the meetings were going to be at on the ship during the cruise. As soon as I got on the ship, I drank Jägermeister and rum and coke and beer. Like, those are my things. So I rationalized, and I was like, I can probably have a strawberry daiquiri. And I started the strawberry daiquiri. I didn't finish it. And I drank scotch for 4 days straight on this cruise. And I was just depressed. That bottomless pit just opened right back up. And I was thinking, like, maybe I should just jump off this ship I just can't do this. And I'm drunk, wandering around the ship with the big book in my hand, trying to figure out why this isn't working for me. That fourth night on the cruise ship, I just felt absolutely desperate. And I was all alone on this ship, and I got down on my knees, and I said the third step prayer out of the big book, and I haven't had a drink since. I got back, and I got with my sponsor, and we got into those causes and conditions. We got into 4 and 5, and got into the book, and he got me into service work, and I was into this thing. And I was so into this thing that for like the first 9 months of my sobriety then, I went and chose to stay at a sober house. I just immersed myself in AA. And then I went through this phase where I was like a crazy big book person, would like use it as a weapon. And then I had like something crazy, like 12 sponsees, and I'd meet all their moms and I'd meet their families. And I was taking meetings into jail, and I was like, I was on fire for AA. I'm glad that stopped, because that was pretty uncomfortable too. Because I think really what I was doing was that I still was very uncomfortable in my own skin and just being busy in AA. That's what I needed. That's what I needed at the time. I was sober for a while. I met my ex-wife in AA. We got serious, and she got pregnant, and we decided to get married. And I was like, I can't be a bartender. I didn't want to be a bartender and be a dad. Like, my standards were a little bit higher now. And I went back to school to become a nurse. And I got accepted into a nursing program that took us an hour away from our fellowship. And I'll tell you, if you haven't moved in sobriety, it is a challenge. Because you're used to these people. You're used to the way they do things. We are very particular people. But I made myself. I found a new home group. I got into service there. I got a new sponsor there, and I made myself do it. I became a nurse, and years went by, and then we decided to buy a house, and the house that we purchased was an hour away from there. And this time, I wasn't so motivated. I really didn't like the AA in the area where I moved to, and I found myself really going to less meetings. I'd still call my sponsor. I'd still talk to the guys that I had sponsored, but I wasn't really a part of this thing, really. Not as I understand it, as I understood it. And I really kind of drifted away from AA for a while. And so did my ex-wife. So then we made the decision to move here to Georgia for a lot of reasons that have changed since then. It's funny. And we moved here, and I was a nurse, she was a nurse. And I don't know, was it not working a program? Maybe it was part of it. Maybe we weren't really as compatible as we thought we were when we first met, because we weren't really fully baked people. And we decided not to be together anymore. I mean, we tried to make that as amicable as possible. We weren't really great at it. There's a lot of nastiness, but we got through it. And in the midst of that, I'm trying to like extra be there for the kids. So she says, I don't want to be married anymore. And the first thought I had was, call your sponsor and get to a meeting. I hadn't been to a meeting more than once a year for years. And that's the first thought that I had. Call your sponsor and get to a meeting. I called my sponsor and I got to a meeting. And I went to the Shelby Clubhouse in Buford, and I was like, oh my God, this is what's been missing. This is what's been missing. As soon as I walked in there, and I met some people right away, and I felt at home, and I started going to meetings regularly. And so I'm back, and I'm calling my sponsor, and I'm doing new step work with him, but in the midst of this divorce proceedings, right, back into this thing at that point. So anyway, I take my daughter to see Florence and the Machine. We're there, we're just having a good time, and suddenly this cop comes up behind me and grabs me, and he says, you have to come with me. And I'm like, all right, man, my daughter's got to come too. And we both walk to the security room, and he says, someone said you were touching her inappropriately. I'm like, man, that's crazy. Like, that's, if you knew me, like, that's the craziest thing anyone would ever say about me. But they had someone come talk to her, and then they didn't do anything. They let us go home. But they did say, we have to let DCF know that this claim was made. Okay, that's fine. Let DCF come. I got no problem with that. And they let us go home together. A couple weeks later, DCF shows up at my house, and they interview me. And then they go to my ex-wife, and they go interview her. And then out of nowhere, they're like, you cannot talk to your children until our investigation is concluded. All right. Okay. I'm in this AA thing more than I've been maybe ever. And I'm doing service and got sponsees, a couple of sponsees at that time. It's like God puts sponsors and sponsees together when you need them, man. They'll show up. And that's been my experience anyway. So I was working with this sponsee, and I leave his house, or I go to meet him at the clubhouse. I leave my house, and I get pulled over and arrested, and I get charged for this crazy stuff. And I can't see any of my children, and now as a nurse, and I had just completed my nurse practitioner program, so I had become a nurse practitioner, so suddenly I cannot work, and I can't see my kids, and that was really hard. That was really, really hard, and I really dug in here. And then shortly after that, I got filed that my ex-wife was filing for full custody. We had agreed on 50-50, and now, so I'm like fighting this criminal case for something I didn't do, and this family law thing that's really unjustified, and I can't work. And I got really not a whole lot of support near me other than Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really dug in, man. I'd wake up in the morning, I'd call my sponsor. Get off the phone, go to the 7 a.m. meeting. Leave the 7 a.m. meeting, call my sponsor or call a friend. Wait for the noon meeting, get out of there, call my sponsor or call a friend. And I was nuts. Like, there was some homicidal ideation. There was some suicidal ideation. Just complete, just like, this is a nightmare I'm living. This feels like I'm never going to get out of this. And the acceptance that I've learned in here, I mean, it can't be accurately described without having lived it yourself, but I got to this point somehow where I was like, yeah, what's the worst that could happen? If you went to prison for something you didn't do, you'll still be able to go to AA there. Maybe that's God's mission for you. Maybe that's what God wants for you. Maybe he wants you to go to jail and carry this message. And you still got hope. You still got a reason to go on. And I don't know, man. Less than a week after I reached that place, everything stopped. Charges were dropped. I was able to see the kids again. I was able to go get the job. It's wild, man. Really wild. So, continued to fight the family thing for a while, and she dropped that. And now it's 50-50. Active in my home group. And I sponsor a couple of guys. They come over. We work the steps together. My wife and I go on adventures. And, yeah. So, I'm a nurse practitioner. Like, I write prescriptions for controlled substances now. And they have no idea. And I don't do that lightly. Like, it's like, you got to really plead your case for me to give you something like that. So, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's been a gift in my life. Gift to my mom's life. Gift to my kids' life. And it continues to be. I think that's about it.
Thank you, Frank. My dad took me to AA when I was a kid, and I ended up needing it. So I thank God for dads that bring their kids to AA. Thank you.
First I slipped, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. Rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promise. All is. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow. get just what we need. On a broad highway, God walks by, we walk eternally. Take me where the promises are.